This meeting is being recorded.
Okay, good afternoon, gentlemen. We are now going to be reviewing for the final for Contemporary Halacha Spring Semester 2020. We're going to go through a number of topics. The first topic I'd like to talk about is the halachas of Tumas Kohanim. That was a shiur given by Rabbi Konigsberg. Now here we have to cover, you know, questions as far as a kohen going to a cemetery, medical school, driving near a cemetery, going in a plane where there's a mace. The Torah in, of course, Parshas Emor that we just learned talks about Tumas Kohen, and there are three types of Tumas Kohen. There's three types of Tumas Mace, I should say. There's Tumas Maga, there's Tumas Masa, and there's Tumas Ohel. And even Tumas Ohel has three subcategories. There's being Ma'il al HaMace. There's the mace being ma'il on the person that's up and on top and on bottom. And then there's ol hamshacha, which is that you're under the same roof, even though you're not directly above the tumah or below the tumah, but you're under the same roof as the tumah. So the question that we have to deal with, which is going to be nogeh halach lemaisa often, is does this tumas mace apply to a mace akum? So the halacha is that tumas akum does apply to tumas maga. It does apply to Tumas Masa. However, when it comes to Ohel, here we have Machlokes Tanoim, Machlokes Rishonim, and even Machlokes between the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, as to whether that Tumah applies to an Akum. So the way we paskin, well, the Shulchan Aruch is Machmir, that Tumas Akum does apply to Tumas Ohel does apply to an Akum, but the Ramah is Mekel. But however, even though the Ramah is Mekel, Mikur Hadin, the Ramah still says we should be Machmir. So Halacha Lemaisa, a Kohen cannot go into a funeral home, even if the funeral is for an Akum. Now, there is a Radogomir Vava that was suggested to be used as maybe you could permit going a Kohen to go to medical school, even though there might be anatomy on a cadaver, based on the following. The Dogma Ravava says the following. He introduces a Raivid. The Raivid talks about a sugya of Tuma b'chiburin. Tuma b'chiburin means that once you're touching Tuma, imagine you're holding on to Tuma in your right hand. Could your left hand become Tuma? Could your left hand touch a mace? So that is called Tuma b'chiburin, and that should be okay. But what happens, what if you touch the mace in the morning? Could a Kohen go ahead and touch another mace that afternoon of the same day? So the Rambam says that that's Asur, because even though it's not adding any additional days to your Tahara process, it's still you're touching another mace. But the Ravid says that since you're not delaying your Hazah, your Paraduma process, so you're not being Mosif Tumal Tumaso, according to the Ravid, once you touched something today, you are permitted to touch something else, another mace, that same day. And the Ravid continues and says that since Kohanim Bizman Hazeh, we're all Tumei Meis, so we're never really concerned with being Mosif Tumal Tamasim, because every day we're choshesh that we're becoming Tumei again, all the time. So there should be no problem Bizman Hazeh, according to this Ravid, for a Kohen to touch another mace. Based on this, it seems like this Ravid, who would be Mekel for a Kohen to touch a mace, Bizman Hazeh, but we don't pass like the Rav, we pass like the Rambam typically. However, suggests the Dogomir of Ava, we could create a Svek Sveka. If we talk about an Akum in an Ohel, where we already had a Machlokas between the Ramah and the Shulchan Aruch, whether there's Tumas Ohel for an Akum. So let's say the Svek Sveka like this. Maybe we pass in like the Ramam Iker Hadin that there's no Tumas Ohel at all. And even if we're machmir that there is Tumas Ohel for an Akum, maybe we could be Mekel like the Ravid, who says that once you're Tamei already, you could become Tamei a second time, because it's Tumah B'chiburin. And that's the Svek Sveka that the Ravid puts forth to allow a Kohen Bizman Hazeh to become Tamei. And based on that, somebody suggested maybe that would also be a Heter for a Kohen to be allowed to go to the to do gross anatomy, not that he could touch the cadaver, but that he could be in the laboratory, and his lab partner would do the dirty work. And even though he's under the same roof, but if the cadaver is a mace akum, so it's just Tumas Ohel for an akum, And if we assume that tuma, that kohanim is manazira tumeim anyway, so it's just being mosif tuma al tumaso for a meis akum, you have the sex feka, that's what some permitted based on this dagel mirvava. However, the Chasam Sofer points out that the Chasam Sofer in, I think it's the Chasam Sofer, the dagel mirvava lemaisa says that no, maybe the Ravid, when the Ravid says that a kohen bizman hazeh is already tummy, and there's nothing to be worried about if he becomes tummy again, that just means we're not going to give him malkos for becoming tummy a second time. It doesn't mean he's actually allowed to touch a mace a second time. There's still going to be an isidor raisa for him to touch it, but we're not going to give him malkos for it. That's what the Dagum Ravava concludes. And also the Chasam Sofer adds that he found another Ravid in Chuvis, in the Chuvis Tumim Deim, where the Ravid says that that there was seems to be have been chozer bo, and seems to hold like the Rambam, that even after you're porish from the mace, if you touch it again, you will get malchus. So again, the Ravid himself might have retracted. And even if he didn't retract, maybe the Ravid still asers this situation. He just says you don't get malchus on it. So therefore, we cannot rely on this this Ravid or the Svek of the Dagum Ravava, of the Nodeb Yehuda in the Dagum Ravava, to permit going to medical school. Furthermore, Rav Moshe Feinstein and Igros Moshe suggest that you can't use the Svara of Pikuach Nefesh either to permit going to medical school. That's because you might be obligated to save a life if you see somebody drowning, but that doesn't mean you have to go to school to save a life. Furthermore, you have non-Jewish doctors. And finally, you even have Jewish doctors who are just not Kohanim. So in the same way, you don't have a chiyuv to go into business to give tzedakah, you also don't have a chiyuv to go to medical school to save lives. And therefore, Moshe says that a kohen should not be able to attend medical school, and based on these svaras, if anatomy is necessary for dental school, the same thing would be true regarding dental school for a kohen. That is the first section. So that was the section of kohanim going to medical school. Now, let's go to the second section. And let me just preface, part of my goal today, as I mentioned half a year ago, is to order and to sort of compress all the shiurim into discrete units, so you know each unit, where it begins, where it ends. So now let's go to the second unit of this shiur, and that's going to talk about Kohanim going to do Bikur Cholim in a hospital. So the issue that we have with going to do Bikur Cholim is that if there is a mace in a hospital, so there's a concern of tumas ohel, which means that anything under the same roof, all the rooms under the same roof, will be mamshech the tumah to all those areas under that same roof. So for example, if you have a mace on a given floor, if the door of that room where the mace is situated is open, so the roof will be mitztaif all the rooms through the hallways, it's all one big ohel. That's one issue. Another issue is that if it's open to if one of those doorways are open to an atrium, when you walk into the hospital, sometimes an atrium could be 8 stories high, right when you walk in to many hospitals, it's a gigantic atrium. If hallways are open to that atrium, it could be that the roof of the atrium encompasses all of the, and all of the floors, and therefore it could be prohibited even to walk into the entrance atrium because of the one mace in one room that have open hallways to that. That's one issue. The second issue is a new sugya, and that's the sugya of sof tuma latzeis, that even if we're able to contain the tuma in the room by closing the doors, nevertheless, there's a halacha called sof tuma latzeis that tells us that wherever the mace will end up leaving through, whatever hallway, whatever elevator, whatever doorway, the mace will end up leaving through, we look at as though, halachically, we perceive as though the mace is there right now. So even if the mace is contained in a room and the tum is contained in a room, however, if he's going to be taken out through a hallway or through an elevator or through a door out of the building, then a kohen is not allowed to be in that hallway or in that door or in that elevator because a mace will subsequently be taken out through that. So that is a... So that means that if a kohen is just going, even if there are no maces in a building, doors open, the mace is contained in a morgue or contained in whatever room and they close the door. But if the mace will be carried through an elevator, so a kohen can't go into that elevator now, even if in 2 hours from now a mace will be going through that elevator to be taken outside. So is there any heter to allow a Kohen into the hospital and potentially to use the elevator or to use the hallways or doors where a Kohen might, where a mace might exit through there? So Shulas Yaakov suggests a svar lahakel. He says maybe the reason why you're going to take a mace out is to bury them. So by a yid where there's a chi of kavura, so there has to be a tuma, there has to be a mace taken out. The mace has to be taken out. So since it definitely has to happen, there will be an isser of sof tuma latzis. Mash ein kev, an akum is not chayv in kavura. So since there's no mechayi for him to be taken out, he could stay there, you know, the mace could theoretically, a mace akum could theoretically stay in a room forever. So there's no iser of sof tuma latzis. That's one svar lahakel. So based on that, Rav Shechter suggests that maybe sof tuma latzis, this whole svar of sof tuma latzis, might only be a chumra derabanan, might only be a din derabanan. And also, that which you're in the same ohel for an akum is also, might only be a chumra. So therefore, if it's one chumra on top of another chumra, maybe you could be makel to allow for an akum that's only, that doesn't have tumas ohel, and on top of some tumas latzeis might itself only be a chumra derabanan. So if you have the two together, maybe Rav Shechter suggests there won't be an issur of sof tumas latzeis, but many are machmir because of the problem of sof tumas latzeis, not to rely on that kula. Fine. Let's talk about another issue of Bikur Cholim. That was one issue of Bikur Cholim. That is, so we have the Tumah, Tumas Hamshacha of the Ohel. Then we have the separate issue of Sof Tumalatzes. And now you have to realize that even if there's no one dead, Baruch Hashem, in a hospital, there are still skeletons in the closets in the most literal sense. There are skeletons, there are bones, there are pieces of bodies that even if there's no dead person there, the bones of a dead body are really are metame and have a din of tumas mace. So that will be a problem even if there's no dead person in the hospital at all. So Ramosha has a very important kula. Ramosha, the Gros Moshe, says that since we could assume, we could follow Rove that anyone who's dead or a cadaver is metame, it's tumas akum. And if it's only tumas akum, mi'ikr hadin, the Ramah seems to paskin that it's mutter mi'ikr hadin for a tumas ohel tumas ohel of a meis akum. Then one would be permitted if there's a tzorach gadol that you're gonna be, you could follow the mi'ikr hadin and be meikel for a kohen to visit the hospital if there is tremendous tsar, if they didn't, like if you have to, a person has to visit their parent or for their wife, shalom bayis concern. But under, in general, a kohen should avoid doing it. But if necessary, there is room to be makel to rely on the fact that me'ikr hadin, you could rely on the rov that it's a meis akum, it's a meis akum, and it is, and we paskin that Meis Akum in an Ohel is Mikra Hadin, not Metame. Fine. That's the end of Bikur Chol, and that's what the Ramosha's Pesach by Bikur Chol. Let's now go to the next point. What is the halacha regarding a pregnant Eishes Kohen? You have a lady named Mrs. Kohen. Baruch Hashem, Mrs. Kohen is pregnant. Shprinzi Kohen is pregnant, and she wants to go to the cemetery, etc. So can she go to Levaya? And so, of course, it's going to be a touchy issue. Nobody knows that she's pregnant yet, and she's not showing it. So she, once she's showing, she has a good excuse. Okay, so there we could use it. The shach suggests that maybe it could be matir based on a svek sveka. What is that? The rokeach, actually. The rokeach says it's a svek sveka. Although the Torah says explicitly, lahazir gdolam al haktan, that you have to ensure that your katan, kohen, does not become tami lemeis, nevertheless, here, when the baby is still in utero, there's a suffik nefel, suffik ben kayama. Maybe it won't be a viable pregnancy. And even if it is a viable pregnancy, it's a suffik zachar, suffik nekeva. So you have a double suffik. You have a suffik nefel, suffik ben kayama. Even if it's a ben kayama, it's a suffik zachar, suffik nekeva. So therefore, it would be muta. That's what the rokeach says. That's the kula of the rokeach. It's sveksveka, to be matir, a pregnant eishes kohen, to go to the cemetery. Yes, the Magen Avraham. Why do you have to come on to a sex veka to be makel? After all, it's Tara Blua. whenever you have something that's swallowed or that's enveloped inside another body, that itself should make it mutter. Why do you have to come on to the svara of sex feka? So Reb Chaim Ozer answers, and Achiezer, he says something very sodistic that we're going to use numerous times throughout the rest of the shir. And that is that Tara Blua is a heter in Hilchos Tuma. But a Kohen, when he's commanded not to come close to a mace, it's not to be metame to an ace, it's not to come close. Meaning, Reb Chaim Ozer is suggesting that even if you're not becoming tuma per se, for example, it's tuma blua, a kohen still cannot come have a kiruv to the mace. So even if technically you're right, because it's tara blua, the fetus might not become tame because it's blua inside the mother's belly. Nevertheless, by coming in proximity, by being in the same ohel mace, that is still coming karav la mace, it will still be aser. And therefore, Reb Chaim Ozer is mechadish this chiddush atzum that tumas kohen is not an iser tuma; it's an iser of kirva. And we're also going to use this svar later on in the shir when we talk about flying over a cemetery. That maybe there you could have a kula. That if you're flying over a cemetery, there is, although it might become tuma from a technical standpoint, but it's not a kirva lemisus. Maybe that would be a heter that Rav Shechter likes to go with that. Okay. Keep in mind, if you do use this, hold on, please. If you do use this svek sveka, so we explained why you needed a svek sveka, but there's still two situations where you might lose the heter of a pregnant woman to go to the cemetery. That is, that once there's a ninth month, she's not the baby's not a suffix nafel anymore. That might be one point, and she won't have the heter. And secondly, if you have an ultrasound, so we know that the woman is, let's say, carrying a boy, there's no suffix nekeva, suffix zacha, so you'll lose out on the svek sveka component. So if you know, if there's a levaya coming up, or hakamas matseva, she should find out if it's a boy or a girl. If it's a boy, she probably should not attend, because it's efshe levarur, it shouldn't be a svek sveka. Yes, what's your question?
You just answered it.
Okay, great. No, we say you cannot rely on the svek sveka if it's easily efshel levrurei. Yeah, you should. Yeah, you can't be mekel by just sticking your head in the sand if you're able to clarify. So that's the end of the quick question of pregnant woman going to a cemetery. But let's use that point that we raised of the Achiezer, that the isser of a tumas kohen is not really to become tummy, it's even to become Karov to Tumah. So there's another halacha called Cherev Harehu Kechalal. Cherev Harehu Kechalal tells us that not only could a Kohen not become Tami Lameis, they're also not able to become Tame to a piece of metal that was Nitma B'meis. That means if there was a scalpel used in a surgery, or if there was a watch that the dead body was wearing, a Kohen is not allowed to touch that. Well, that's a machlokas in the Ramah. The Ramah Lameis is Mekel. But on the concept in general, Reb Chaim Cohen in Tosfos quotes Reb Chaim Cohen, who's in Nazir, quotes Reb Chaim Cohen, who asks, "What do you mean? But every house has a piece of metal that contacted a tumas mace. How could it ever be mutter?" So perhaps with this yisod of the Achiezer, we could explain that although it might be formally technically tamei, it still might be okay for a Kohen to live in a house, you know, that has metal things in it that might have at one time been on the body or in the same room as a mace, because you're not coming close to a mace. And the Isra, as we said a moment ago, is not necessarily just to become tummy, technically, but rather to come in a proximity to be close to a mace. This svara that we just said of Cherev Harehu Kechalal was used by Rav Goren as another kula to allow Kohanim into medical school. Why? What do? You take a watch. You send the watch with somebody going to a funeral. That watch is now tame. Okay, the halacha is that we pass, and again, it's machlokas about Cherev Harehu Kechalal, but we pass in Maisa Lahakel. So therefore, the Kohen will now, who wants to go to medical school, will put this watch on his wrist. He's now, although he's he was allowed to do that, Mi'ikar Hadin was machlokas, but he was allowed to do that. Once he does it, based on the Tumah b'chibur, and right now he's mamish tameh. He's mamish touching something that will make him tameh. He's mamish. It's not that he was tummy earlier today, so he could become tummy a second time. He's being tummy right now, wearing this watch. So therefore, he should be able to, if once he's touching it's like touching a mace with your left hand and becoming tummy a second, another time with your right hand, which should be mutter, right? Everyone should agree to that because he's being tummy right now. That's what Rav Goren suggested, to wear a watch that's went to a funeral and therefore be able to now go to medical school and become tummy again as long as you're wearing this watch. So this, Rav Schechter rejects it very simply by saying that although the reason why we were makel touching the watch is only because you're not coming close to the dead body. But in a case where you are coming close to the dead body, like in an anatomy lab, so there's no reason to be makel because you are indeed coming close to the dead body. Fine. So therefore, we don't have that kula to go to medical school of the Rav Shlomo Goren. So that was the second svara lahakel, to allow someone to go to medical school, and that's also a sign that we reject, period. Now let's go to the next topic. The next topic is, what about a car? If you're driving a car, could you go over a road that goes over a cemetery? So theoretically, we know that if you're in a box, you're in a kli, the kli should serve as a chatzitza, and it should be chotzeis from the tumah, that it should insulate you from the tumah that is outside. The problem is that a car has certain problems. Well, number one is that a car is an ohel zaruk. It's a kli, and it contains you, but it can't insulate the tumah, it can't prevent the tumah from entering because it's an ohel zaruk. And ohel zaruk, lo shmei ohel. That's one problem. Second problem, even if you assume that ohel zaruk is an ohel, maybe because it's supposed to move, or it has wheels that's still on the ground, so it's not an ohel zaruk, but still there will be a problem with a car as an insulating material, because a car is made out of metal. And anything that itself, any kli that itself is mekabel tumah, cannot be chotzeitz bifnei hatumah. So those are two problems why a car would not help you. And therefore, if you're going over a cemetery, you really can't be, you can't drive over certainly a Jewish cemetery, and even a non-Jewish cemetery, there's what to discuss. Okay, what about if you pass by under trees? So passing by under trees also could be a problem depending on the circumstance. We're not going to go into those circumstances. Now, let's go to the next topic. What about an airplane flying over a cemetery, as many flight patterns do have over the Cholon Cemetery in... One second, please. Okay, so regarding an airport, the issue is that the airplane is flying mamish over a kever, and that's really an iser daraisa. What's the question? The question is, maybe the plane that's surrounding the kohen is serving as a chatzitza between the tumah of the low from the grave and the kohen who's sitting in row, 21C, C21C. So the question is, can the metal, we said metal cannot be chotis min hatumah, but wait a second, this is not regular metal. Planes are not made out of regular metal, they're made out of aluminum. Aluminum is not listed in the Torah. When the Torah lists the six metals that are listed in the Torah that are mekabel tumah. So the Gra suggests that only the six metals that are specified in the Torah have a din of metal, and therefore aluminum, which is not one of those six metals listed in the Torah, would not have a din of metal, and therefore a plane which is made out of metal can be chotzeitz bifnei hatumah. That's the Gra's opinion. However, the Tiferes Yisrael on the Mishnayos say, no. Those six metals listed in the Torah are just general metals, but anything that has the same property, that are metallic in their properties, would also have a din of metal, and therefore would not be chotzeitz bifnei hatumah, in which case aluminum planes would taka transfer tumah, would not be chotzeitz bifnei hatumah, would be a problem. So therefore, a plane should be problematic. However, based on what we said earlier, Rav Schechter suggests, if we take the lamdas of the achiyaz that we said 10 minutes ago, that the iser for a kohen is not just to technically become tameh. Yes, he will technically become tameh by flying over a grave, but the iser is to become close to the mace. If you're flying 1,700 feet above the grave, above the cemetery, that's not going to be considered coming close, and therefore that will not, although the coin might become tame, it's not going to violate the Isser of Tumas Kohen because he didn't come close. Let's finish this shiur with a different question. Not a question of flying over a graveyard, but what about a dead body in the cargo of the plane itself? So the goal would be to put the body inside a box, a plastic or a silicone box that's not mekabel tumah, and if it's enclosed, insulated in a box, it will be chotzeitz and insulate the tumah from coming outside of it. And therefore, the tumah will not go into the passenger section. That's the goal. Some problems. Number one is that this box is an ohel zarek, right? Ohel zarek lav shmei ohel, so it won't be able to insulate and keep the tumah inside of it. Well, here you could argue, wait a second, the box is flying, yeah, but so are the people on, so is Mr. Cohn, who's in the passenger section. He's also flying. So relative to the passenger, the box isn't flying. But on the other hand, others say no. So others reject that cool and say, so the box is flying. So just because the coin's flying, that doesn't help you in terms of the fact that the box is flying. The box is flying through the air inside the plane. And therefore, it's also an ohel zarek. That's one point. Another point is, even if the box is chotzeitz, but the box, if you just had a box with a dead body in it, in the air at 4,000 feet, it would fall down. So what's holding it up? What's holding it up is the airplane. Oh, the airplane, because it's made out of aluminum, and because it has steel bolts in it, the airplane itself is mekabel tuma, and therefore, what's maimid, even if we say the box is not mekabel tuma because it's made out of plastic, but we're being maimid the box with the davar mekabel tuma. And therefore, that should also be a problem. So therefore, it's better for a Kohen, for Mr. Cohen, not to go on flights where there's a dead body. That's the end of this shiur. Any questions about this shiur? Okay. So let's go to the next shiur. Let's talk. What's that?
Is that something you can desire with a airplane, with a I don't know, allow, for example, you could just call them and be like, I prefer not to fly on a flight with this dead body?
So I think Rabbi Konigsberg mentioned that out of Newark, they usually do not take bodies. Out of JFK, they usually do take bodies, but you theoretically might be able to, if you could confirm, you could confirm. You have to ask the Kohanim, you know, on the ground, what, the you know, the practically, how do you find out? Yes, Barak. Yes, Tumas Maga, that's touching, Tumas Masa, that's carry, and Tumas Oel being in the same, under the same roof.
Thank you.
Okay.
What's the negative show about Kohen visiting people in hospitals?
You should try to avoid it, and you mean, are they make a, like, Ramosha's Kula?
None of that can work because the hospital's filled with Jews.
That's correct. So therefore, outside of the hospitals, there's a small sign that says Kohen can enter or cannot enter. That's right. You don't have the row of Akum there. Correct. Okay.
Yeah.
So now let's talk about brain death. Okay, we talked about dead bodies. We're moving to life slowly but surely. So we talked about totally dead people. Now we're talking about brain dead people. And then hopefully we'll get to living people shortly. So brain death. So we're not going to go through the Muragadata part of the brain death discussion. There are different times in Tanakh where there were Vayofeg Libo and Eliyahu, who was the Kohen, Pinchas was Eliyahu, and he was Mechaya, the Ben of the Tzarfatit. Was he really dead? Was the child really dead? Was the child not really dead? We're not going to talk about that. The Shilas started, I don't know if they started, but the Shila came to the fore in the 1700s, when one of the governments decided that you shouldn't bury bodies until 3 days after death to make sure that the body's really, really, really dead. So there the questions arose, what should we do if we have a halacha of not delaying our kvura? Should we wait? Is there concern with, we have a mitzvah of kavortik brenu bayom hahu. On the other hand, maybe it's safik pikuach nefesh. So all the poskim basically came out that you can't wait the 3 days. It's not a real concern of Pikuach Nefesh. Now, one might have raised the question based on a chazal, Mesechtas Ketanos, and Mesechtas Smachos. It talks about a story that they once found somebody who had been buried, or perhaps had been put in a kuch, in like one of these wall inserts, probably not buried, because if he's buried, he probably couldn't dig himself out. But if they used to, they didn't do underground burials, they would put the body into a shelf until it would disintegrate, and then they would bury the bones afterwards. So they found this guy in a kuch, and he lived for 25 years longer, and he had a whole bunch of kids, he had 5 kids afterwards, after they discovered him. So maybe you see from that there is some kind of pikuach nefesh. So the Chasam Sofer says, absolutely not. That's not how Torah works. We have a Mesorah, what death means. We have a Mesorah, whatever death happens, just because a few doctors are concerned, there's no unique, you know, scientific discovery that prompted this question. Just like, oh my gosh, maybe dead people are really not dead. So such a concern is not something that we will take seriously, and that will not be matir, the Ister of Halanas Hameis. So now let's get into the more technical aspect of brain death from medical, where the medical perspectives begin. For all of history until 1968, if a heart stopped beating, then the person, if there's no blood, then there's no blood coming, you know, the heart doesn't beat, so there's no blood to the brain. The brain doesn't work, and then because the brain doesn't work, the heart the body starts breathing, you know, a few seconds or minutes after that. Until 1968, when the invention of the respirator or the ventilator, which inserts oxygen and blows oxygen into the lungs. So all of a sudden, you have a disconnect between brain function and the function of the heart. What that means is, let's say the brain stops functioning. For whatever reason, that there was a traumatic brain injury, and the brain stops functioning. That brain stops functioning, it will no longer control the breathing, but guess what? As long as oxygen is being delivered to the lungs, the lungs will send oxygen to the heart will continue to beat, even though the brain is not functioning at all. So all of a sudden, you have the invention of the possibility of a dead brain, but a beating heart. So as long as we manually or, you know, mechanically pump oxygen into the lungs, and lungs keep on providing oxygen to the heart, the heart will continue to breathe, the heart will continue to pump, even though the brain is not functioning. So is that considered death? Is that not considered death? Do we say that since the body is beating, therefore the heart is beating, so the person's alive? On the other hand, the heart is beating because, you know, the guy's dead already. You were just pumping air and making the heart beat even after he's dead. That's the question. So, of course, there was the famous Harvard Medical School criteria that suggested that maybe brain death could be considered death, even though the heart is still pumping, but maybe the person's not responsive and there's no breathing on its own. It's only because we're pumping air into him and there's no reflex and all the other things. So we could consider that person dead. And if that's the case, then if any government would accept that definition of death. So it's possible if you have a body that's pumping its blood because we're feeding it air. And the blood is traveling throughout the body. And therefore the organs are in excellent condition. You could have a great specimens from which to source your organ harvesting to donate all kinds of organs because the body is kept functioning, and even though the brain is not there, the brain is completely not functional. So that's really what the question is. Do we consider this body that has a pumping heart, but and therefore it's breathing only because it's you're breathing air into it, and which keeps the heart pumping, but the brain is non-functional at all? Will this body be able to provide organs for organ transplantation? So that's one issue. Could you do organ transplants? Another nafkamina, let's talk about just some nafkaminas of brain death. Number one is organ transplants. If he's dead, you could take his organs. If he's not dead, you can't take an organ, which will kill him, because you want to help somebody else live. Number two, if he's dead, then you could disconnect the respirator from a dead body. If he's still alive, you cannot disconnect him from a respirator because taking out the air will stop the air going stop the O2 from going to the hearts, and you'll kill him. Number three, is there a chiv kavur yet? Number four, if this guy is in the hospital, could a kohen come into this hospital? Because after all, this guy has been, he could be brain dead for 2 years, being pumped with oxygen, and he could be dead, sitting dead, but you know, being pumped with atzah and his heart is beating for 2 years. And of course, the question about an aguda shaila, his wife, could his wife marry while he's brain dead, or is he still alive? All those are nafkamina, is basically, is a person dead or not? Okay, so the shaila begins with a somewhat enigmatic Gemara in Yuma Pehei, where it talks about ad heichon hu bodek, if you find somebody collecting under a pile of rubble, you want to see if the person's alive, if you're allowed to be mechala Shabbos Yontif. There are no people there. Sorry. So the Gemara there raises the question, do you have to check this body to see if it's alive ad chotmo or ad libo? Check the nose or the heart. So really, it seems like the Gemara is asking the question, what is life? Are you allowed to be mechalel Shabbos? Do we look at the heart, which means the beating, or do we look at the chotem, the nostrils, which means breathing? And if the Rishonim passing as they do, that it's ad chotmo, that means we look at breathing. So that means if we look at breathing, then that means if a person is brain dead, they are not breathing on their own, even though their heart is beating, but they're not breathing on their own, they're dead. So if this Gemara would be talking about what is death, the heartbeat or the breathing, then the answer clearly would be that breathing is, we pass in that breathing is the criteria of death, and brain dead is dead because a brain dead person does not breathe. We just pump air into them, so the heart is still beating. However, the Rashi explains that Gemara not like I just said. Rashi explains that the Gemara is not telling you when what is considered to be death, whether it's the mouth or the heart. Rashi understands that Gemara to be saying, how do you determine whether or not the heart is beating? Do you determine the heart is beating by just checking the heart? Or maybe it's too weak a pulse, and you're not going to be able to see the heartbeat based on the heart, and you should see if there's any breathing, because even if there is breathing, then you know the heart is still pumping. According to Rashi, it seems that the Gemara is telling us that a brain-dead person is not dead. A brain-dead person is alive. Why? Because their heart is indeed beating. And the question is, do you check their heartbeat through looking at their chest, or do you check their heartbeat by seeing if they're breathing? Because if they're breathing, then the heart is still beating. And therefore, this Gemara is not telling you the criteria for death, whether death is breathing or a heartbeat. Rather, everyone agrees that breathing is totally on the heartbeat. The question is, how do you test or measure if there is a heartbeat? Is it enough to just check the heart, or do you also have to check his heartbeat by seeing if he's breathing a little bit or not? So that is the Gemara, the main Gemara that's under dispute in terms of how to understand it, to tell you. And if we learn like Rashi, then it would come out that if the heart is beating, the person is indeed still alive, because we know that a heart is beating. We don't have to check the heart, we don't have to check the mouth, we could just, you know, plug our machinery in and we see the heart is beating, so we know that he's alive. And if he's alive, then a brain-dead person is indeed very much alive. And of course, you cannot take his organs, he's not dead. That is one Gemara. There's one other Chazal, and that's a Mishnah in Ahalos. Mishnah in Ahalos is talking about when is a person mitame, and it says that a person is only mitame once he's dead, right? A ghost is not mitame, but only a dead person is mitame. The Mishnah continues and says that if you chop off a head, then even if the body is convulsing, what's called pirchus, that person will still be mitame. I think it might be true by animals also, if it's a nevela, if it's metame also, if it's dead nevela. Just like when you chop off, let's say, the tail of a salamander, or the tail of some other things, the tail might still jump around because there are some nervous reactions, there are these convulsions, post-death convulsions. That's not life. That's what the Mishnah says. So now, this Mishnah could be understood in numerous ways. This Mishnah is clearly telling us that if there's a decapitation, then there's death. That's the definition of death. Even if the body seems to be very much jumping all over the place, right? The body's doing jumping jacks, the head's rolling somewhere else, those jumping jacks are jumping jacks from a dead man. So there are four ways to understand this Mishnah. What's the significance of decapitation? So Rabbanut says, well, clearly, once you chop off the head, he's not breathing. So if he's not breathing, he's dead. And therefore, if you can't breathe on your own, because even if the body is doing whatever it wants, but if there's no breathing, if it can't breathe on its own, which is what a brain dead situation is, a brain dead person cannot breathe on their own. There's no spontaneous respiration. So then a person would be dead. The problem is that we know that there are quite a few people who can't breathe on their own. People have polio, people on iron lungs. Christopher Reeve, he was married and he was speaking all over the country. He was living only because he was on some kind of respirator machine that was enabling him to breathe. He didn't have spontaneous respiration and he was very much alive. So it's hard to understand how that should be the case in the Mishnah in Alas. Rabbi Tendler has another way to read this Mishnah Alas. Rabbi Tendler says that he thinks that this Mishnah is a proof that brain death is considered brain death. What's the proof? Rabbi Tendler suggests that if the Mishnah is telling us that if you cut off the head, you're dead, that means that if the brain is not doing its job of running the body, of administering, of doing all the things the body needs to take care of, then we should call this body dead. And therefore, he suggested that even though there's no physical decapitation, you didn't cut the head off, but the brain just isn't working, it's brain dead, therefore it's not doing its job of taking care of the body, of integrating all the body parts, and we should call that dead. It's a very nice svara. In my view, it's a good proof for the Mishnah, but it's just not true, because there's a government report that demonstrated that even for a brain dead person, when the brain is dead, somehow the body is still working as a whole. It's maintaining a temperature. It maintains a blood pressure. That all comes from a brain-dead brain. So you can't say that a brain-dead brain is not doing anything. It is doing something, even though they're very elementary functions. So that's a rejection of Rav Tendler's position. He wanted to prove that brain death is considered death and you can harvest organs, but that seems to be refuted. Rav Bleich suggests, and Rav Schechter all sort of says like this also, the following. He says something very simple. You know why the Mishnah tells you that if you chop off the head, the body is, then the person's dead? It's telling you that normally a convulsing, moving body would demonstrate life. However, whenever you have movement, there's life. Whenever you have any movement whatsoever, any movement, even the heart beating of a heart, that's called life. Except if you chop off the head. If you chop off the head, that's the way of telling you that I don't care what's happening below that severed neck. Everything is going to be dead. It's going to be considered death. But if you don't have the head chopped off, then any other movement that you see, any other movement is a demonstration that there is life there. And therefore, a beating heart would be considered alive. And that's why Rav Bleich and Rav Schechter would assume, we'll talk about Rav Schechter in another moment, that brain death is not death. There is still vital motion occurring. There is still the heart is still beating, and therefore it's still alive. Similarly, Rabbi Yashiv, the Tzitz Eliezer, Vazim, they all reject brain death. They all say a brain dead person is indeed alive, and of course it would be ritzicha to harvest body, to harvest organs for the purpose of organ donation. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman has a fourth way to understand this Mishnah. Which we're not going to go into. I want to just finish off this year with one point that Rav Schechter makes. Rav Schechter points out that in Chazal, we have three Evarim Shaneshama Tluya Behen. Chazal say that the Neshama is totally on the heart, the brain, and the liver. The problem is that we don't know if, when we say that it's totally on three organs, the heart, the brain, and the liver, does that mean all three? If you lose the functionality of the heart, and of the brain, and of the liver, then you have three things that are all neshama tliya b'hen, and you're missing all three, then the person's dead? Or even if any one of those three is missing, if the heart, the neshama is totally on the heart, no heart, you're dead, you're dead. The neshama is totally on the brain, no brain, then you're dead. So you need all three, and if you don't have all three, you're missing one of them, maybe then you're dead. So we don't know which way to learn, says Rav Schechter. We don't know if the neshama, the evarim shah, neshama tliya b'hen is all three, or one, or the other, or the other. In which case, we have a question. Let's say somebody's brain dead, so he doesn't have a brain. But he still has a heart and a liver, certainly a heart, and therefore, he might be alive. You have no right to harvest organs because of that suffix that he might be alive, because he might need all three Evarim Shana Shava Tuliyah Behem to be missing or to be broken. That was the shiur about brain death. Any questions about brain death? Okay. Let's...
Is there ever a time where it's mutter l'kulei alma?
No. Unless he's dead, not brain death. Unless he's dead where his heart is also not beating. Where there's neither a heartbeat nor a spontaneous respiration. Then he's dead, according to everybody. And then we'll bury him. So any funeral that you went to was l'kulei alma, I hope. Yes, Mitchell. I don't want to say, but I'm assuming that most of our Rebbeim would assume that it's a question of Ritzicha. But you have to ask each individual Rav, because Rav Tendler wouldn't hold that way. But other than Rav Tendler, I think Rav Tendler holds it's permitted, or maybe even a mitzvah, I assume. Because again, if he holds that you're dead already, so it would be a mitzvah. It could be that many of the other Rebbeim would assume it's at least a question of a Suffolk Ritzicha, and would be problematic. But you have to ask your local Orthodox rabbi. Okay.
Didn't we also have to be machmir? We have to tell Kohanim to be machmir and not go into places where there are people with respirators?
Well, there are plenty of people on respirators who are not brain dead. Mm-hmm. A brain dead person can only stay alive if they're on a respirator. But you have plenty of people on respirators who are definitely not brain dead. Varaya, you have, right now in COVID, you have so many people who are on respirators and they came off. Anybody who's brain dead is not coming back. Anyone who's on brain dead is not, is never coming back. There was never a report of somebody who was classified as brain dead and they came back. So they're never coming back. The question is, are they still alive or not? But anyway, we see plenty of people on respirators who come, get off respirators.
Yeah, the Cohen whose parent is Chalila and considered brain dead.
So yeah, so according to Rabbi Tendler, that brain death is death. So they wouldn't be able to go, according to the other poskim, that they're still alive. So you'd still be able to go. We'll be telling the same Shaila. Okay, let's talk about infertility in halacha. This was Rav Ilan Sigelman. This is a little bit less technical this year. So typically, what do we consider to be classified as infertility? There's no real definition. It's just in America, typically they assume if there's 12 months of unprotected bia, then that's considered infertility. That's just when they'll start, treating you. But the question is, it could be, but it depends on the age. The most significant factor in fertility is the age of the wife. Now, it's important to realize that when it comes to infertility, the problems of infertility are typically one third of the time the woman's problem, one third of the time it's the man's problem, and one third of the time it's approximately one third of the time it's the problem of the team, the man and woman together, that's the problem. So what are the most common causes of infertility is age, because as opposed to a man who is creating zera all the time, a woman had her eggs from the moment she was born. And therefore, when she is born, she has all the eggs that she will ever have. And as she gets older, her eggs become fewer as they are released during ovulation, which we'll talk more about later. And also, her eggs become a lower quality because of their aging. And there will not only be a lesser ability as they age to become impregnated, they'll also have a greater chance of miscarrying. It happens to be that, women's best chances are, as they're closer to the younger ages, once there's a significant drop between once they hit 30, and there's a much more significant drop when they hit 35. And after age 45, there are many clinics won't even accept patients because it's almost like a brach levatala. It's not always that way, but there are clinics like that. Okay. And clinics always want to get as good numbers as they can because they're rated based on their numbers. So if they think they're not going to have a good chance to be successful, they'd rather not take the case because it's bad for their numbers. So there's a common problem of infertility called PCOS, poly cystic ovarian syndrome. And it's very common among Ashkenazi women, and it's the most common issue. And they hear, what is PCOS? The eggs are shot out of the ovary, but for some reason they can't develop properly. Maybe because there are a lot of eggs that come out at one time, so none of them are able to properly develop. And if they don't develop properly, there's not going to be, they don't travel down the tubes and allow ovulation. But this could be fixed with some medicine, so that's something that's easy to deal with. Another issue that could cause, well, again, we're talking about what are possible causes of infertility. Another cause of infertility could be a halachic issue, early ovulation, because we know that ovulation is around the time of ovulation is when she could conceive, when the egg is coming down. And if she conceives before she comes back from the mikvah, and there might not be so much time, when she comes back from the mikvah, it might pass the ovulation period, at which point there's not going to be an opportunity for conception. Another issue, we'll talk about that more in a minute, another issue is endometriosis. And endometriosis is not really an infertility, I don't know if it's an infertility issue or not, but it's just that a woman's period makes her really knocked out and she has to take the day off or 2 days off from work. That's not an infertility issue. That's just something to be aware of. Let's explain what we mentioned just a moment ago, the question of early ovulation. This is often a significant for halacha purposes and for rabbanim. And how does ovulation, what's the schedule for ovulation? Typically, ovulation is 14 days before, again, not after, but 14 days before the next period. Once ovulation happens, that means once the egg gets shot into the fallopian tubes and is waiting for a zera to meet with it, once ovulation happens, once 24 hours after that happens, there is a zero chance of pregnancy. So only if bia is before or during ovulation could she become pregnant. And we know that zera could live for about 72 hours. So that means if she goes to the mikvah on day 12 and she ovulates, let's say, on day 14 of her cycle, so the bia is on day 12 and day 13 and day 14 could potentially impregnate her. But bia after day 14 when she ovulated, even though she's mutter to her husband for the next week and a half, they are not going to be bias that will yield a pregnancy. So that brings a halachic concern if, for example, a woman has a short cycle. Let's say, again, a normal cycle is a 28-day cycle, so 2 weeks before that, 14 days before that, is day 14. So if she went to the mikvah on day 12, which is normal, she has 3 days to possibly become pregnant. However, let's say a woman's cycle is 25 days. So if her cycle is 25 days, that means she ovulates 14 days before that, that's day 11. Wait a second, but she doesn't go to the mikvah until day 12, because she needs 5 days to make sure she's not bleeding, and then 7 days of Yizayin Nikiyim. So she can only go to the mikvah on day 12, and she ovulated the day before that, she's not going to be able to become pregnant no matter what. So if a woman has a short cycle, we're going to have to fix that, because we'll see how, but otherwise she will not be able to become pregnant. You could have the opposite situation. Let's say a woman, for some reason, is roa dam more than the regular 4 or 5 days. She's bleeding for 6, 7 days. She has a hard time getting a clean hefsek tara. So she ends up going to the mikvah on day, not day 12, but day 13, day 14. On day 14, she might, she first goes to the mikvah on day 14. The ovulation is right around then. She might, she might not get to the mikvah till right after the ovulation if she had a lot of bleeding. So the two, again, to repeat, there are two issues, two halachic issues that will affect, based on ovulation, that will affect her ability to become pregnant. One is if she has a short cycle. The other, she has longer bleeding and therefore can't go to the mikvah until later. In both cases, there's a possibility that she will miss the opportunity of ovulation, which is what will allow her to become pregnant. Okay, that's as far as women are concerned. With men, there's a different concern, and that is if a man could potentially have a varicose seal, spelled in a funny way, don't try to spell it correctly. A varicose seal is that the men's aver has additional veins or bigger veins that cause additional heat, and if there's additional heat, it could ruin the production of the zera in the man's body, and that could theoretically be cured by a certain surgery to cure the varicose seal to improve the man's zera. Obviously, there are certain other sicknesses that can make a person have problems with fertility. We don't have to go into those specific symptoms. Now, let's talk about how the menstrual cycle works with, you know, just for 3 seconds, so we could see what the solution could be. The way, again, I'm not trying to be claiming to be a doctor and an endocrinologist, but just the one point that we really need to realize is that once a month, when a woman is, a woman produces FSH, follicle stimulating hormone. Now, she also produces something called LH, which is the luteinizing hormone. Now, when the LH gets to the top of its secretion, when it surges, when it peaks, that causes the eggs to shoot out into the fallopian tube, and that is the moment of ovulation. So, for example, when you have an ovulation kit, they're just checking to see when you reach that spike of LH in the urine. When it's the highest LH, this luteinizing hormone, that's an indication that ovulation is happening. That's the best time for conception. Now, if the follicle is, the follicle is being produced or pushed out by this follicle-stimulating hormone, and a woman is having her ovulation too early, right? Let's say she's having her ovulation too early, and therefore by the time she comes back from the mikveh, she'll have missed it. So what could we do? We could do something to push off the FSH, to delay, to inhibit the FSH, and therefore delay the opportunity for that ovulation to begin. So if a woman would be given estrogen, then that pushes off the follicle stimulation, and the follicle stimulation will make the ovulation happen a little bit later. So in such a case, if a woman has a shorter cycle and we're worried that she's going to ovulate even before she gets back from the mikveh, by giving her estrogen, which inhibits the FSH, that will delay the ovulation until she's back from the mikveh, so there's a chance she'll be able to get pregnant. So that's one option. You can give her estrogen. Another option to help a woman, now let's talk about options to help a woman who has a short cycle. So number one is you give her estrogen, it makes her cycle, it makes the ovulation happen a few days later. Another kula that we could rely on to help a woman who has a short cycle is to be mekel, like the mechaber against the Ramah, to allow a woman to do her hefsek, not to wait till day 5, but to do a hefsek on day 4. That'll gain one extra day if she, lamais, is clean by day 4. It's not always the case. Another kula might be to, suggest that she, if she has problems with bedikas, if she has a lot of staining or the like, then you could suggest that she do fewer bedikas based on the halachas, which we're not going into now. Alternatively, if you have a question of maybe she's bleeding but not real dam nida bleeding, she could always send it to a bodekas tara to ensure that it's really dam nida from the uterus as opposed to just bleeding from the canal, which is not aser. Those are different halachic things that could be adjusted, or perhaps also wearing colored undergarments or white pads or not mekabel tumah during the zainakim to help a woman get her zainakim. But those are all halachic possibilities to help out a little bit. But sometimes the estrogen doesn't help, and these halachic, you're just going to gain a little bit from these halachic opportunities. So then we have the possibility of IUI, intrauterine insemination. All that means is you take zera and you shoot it through a long tube into her fallopian tube. And whatever you couldn't accomplish because the zera wasn't able to get where it had to go, here you are turbo boosting the zera through a syringe and just pushing it through into exactly where you wanted to get, and that could solve some problems. Obviously, not all problems. It depends on her. If she has an egg there, but it's the problem with the man, or his zera doesn't swim so well, or they have a problem with their intimacy, or the zera has to be donated by somebody else for whatever reason, or the woman is ovulating early, and therefore she's asur to her husband. So she's still asur. She's in the middle of her zainakim, and she's ovulating. So all you could do is take the zera from the man, and we'll talk about that later, and shoot the zera into her while she's a nida, before she goes to the mikvah, and she could become pregnant while she's still a nida. So wait a second. If she's becoming pregnant while she's a nida, because you took the zera, right? There's no bias iser, because there's no bia. You just shot the zera into her. But is the child a ben nida? So if we assume that a ben nida is totally on the maisa bia, not on the conception, then it won't be a ben nida. I guess it depends on how you look at the din of the ben nida. Now, let's go to the next point. What are some of the issues, which we'll talk about in a moment, but if you have IUI, shooting the zera in, or if you have the more complicated procedure, which is IVF, in vitro fertilization, where you don't shoot zera into the woman, rather you extract an egg from a woman, and you take the zera from the man, you put them together in a petri dish or in a test tube, you develop the test tube for 6-7 days in a laboratory, and then after there was conception in the test tube, you take it and you implant this multi-cell organism into the mother. That's IVF, that's in vitro fertilization. So we have a number of issues. First of all, is that considered pruravu or not? Bishmul is mash that it is pruravu. Rav Shechter holds no, it's not pruravu, but most poskim do consider pruravu. Another question is if the father was motzi zera outside the woman's body and it was then implanted into her, is he the father? Is the child miyuchas achara because it's not his bia that gave birth to this child? Another question is, do you need supervision? Who says that the zera from this man is going to his wife? Maybe you have to have supervision. The obvious question is, how are you going to do otzar zelavatal to procure the zera to inject either into the woman or into the test tube? The question that we raised a moment ago is, are you allowed to inseminate her while she's a nida? Obviously, there are a lot of Shabbos shilas, in terms of there are exact times that a woman needs to get certain shots, or need to be monitored, or need to be harvested, her eggs need to be harvested. What happens if it happens on Shabbos, Yontif? These shilas definitely come up for Rabbanim. Another shila is when they take out the eggs from a woman, or they insert the zera into the woman, is that plita shechas zera that will make her tamea, or will knock out her zainakim, or will be considered that it is considered zainakim even if she has this? Those are also shilas which we're not going to get into. Another shila is, can an IVF baby have a Shabbos bris? Rav Shechter happens to be machmir because he holds that there's no tumas leida that, based on a Rav Chanan, holds there's no tumas leida for maisa nisim. And maybe IVF has a din of maisa nisim, so it doesn't have tumas leida, in which case there's no bris. And of course, the very, very controversial question that is very painful is, what happens if you have a single woman who wants to get a sperm donation to become a single mother? That's also a question that's nogeh to this sugya. Now, we do have source in the Torah. Let's talk about IUI. Interuterine insemination of just being zorek zera, we have a Gemara about that. The Gemara of Nizra Ba'ambati talks about a woman in a bathtub and zera that's floating around in the bathtub because a man was there previously goes into her body. So that's a Mefurisha Gemara, and this is a machlokas if that is considered a pruravu. And fine. Let's just talk about a different component, Hotzah Zer Levatala. So theoretically, this isn't Levatala. If a man has to procure Zera in order to inject it into his wife to have a child, that's not Levatala. That's the greatest Hotzah Zera for the purpose of having a child. So the Chorit should be Mutter even via what the Poskim call Niyaf Biyad, even through masturbation. However, on the Pasuk of Lo Sinaf, the Rishonim say that niyuf biyad or niyuf biregel, causing through one's hands or one's legs to cause a person to be motzi zera to ejaculate, is an issa d'oraisa, separate and aside from the component of hotzah zera levatala per se, and therefore that would be usur, even if it would be to provide opportunity for fertility treatment. So that's something that has to be discussed by the family's rav. Okay, that's the end of this shiur. I think we'll do one more shiur but I just need to switch phones because this phone is dying. Okay, so hold on for a minute, please. This is working. Could I ask somebody to unmute themselves or give me the thumb? If you could hear me, could you give me the thumbs up?
Yes, we can hear you, Rebbe.
Okay, great. Okay, thank you. So let's continue. Okay, so let's do one more shiur. Let's do the international dateline, and we'll finish with that for today. Now, the international dateline has just about 3 points. First is trying to understand what the concept of an international dateline is. Now, the best way to understand it is the following. If you fly on a plane from New York to Eretz Yisrael, you're going to be flying into, right? It's an hour later to get to Eretz Yisrael. So if you fly and you're traveling, flying through the air, As you go a little bit, it becomes an hour later, an hour later, an hour later, an hour later. And once you get to Eretz Yisrael, you're 7 hours ahead. And it's now going to be, let's say right now it's 2 o'clock on Tuesday. You're going to get to it right now in Eretz Yisrael, it's 9 p.m. The problem is, if you go to Eretz Yisrael on the other direction, fly to Los Angeles, fly over the Pacific Ocean, and go the other way to get to the same point on the opposite side of the ball, you're going earlier and earlier. When you go to Los Angeles, it's 3 hours earlier. You keep on going east, it gets earlier and earlier and earlier. So when you go to Eretz Yisrael in one direction over the Atlantic, you're going later and later. When you go to over the Pacific, you're getting earlier and earlier. And you get to the same spot on the other side of the world. It ends up being that if you took one flight, if you took the from New York over the Atlantic flight, it's 12 hours later. If you took the New York over the Pacific flight, it's 12 hours earlier. And you are going to have a contradiction because depending on, you're going to have two people fly out of New York in the same time and they go 180 degrees around the world. For one, it's going to be 12 hours later. For the other, it's going to be 12 hours earlier. That means they're going to be in different days. So therefore, we have to have some arbitrary line, which is totally arbitrary, at which we'll decide that they are the first ones to be considered to have a new day. And they're going to be the ones that are going to be, we decide that this is a Sunday for somebody, and that same, that line, 1 inch on one side of the line will be called Sunday, 1 inch on the other side of the line will be called Monday, even though it's the same time in both places. But we have to have a different day, otherwise you can't have two people travel to get to the same point by traveling in different directions, and one's going forward in time, one's going back in time. So we have to just create an arbitrary time where we'll say that their shkia of that location will be the first place to accept the new day. Now, how do we decide when or where the dateline should be? And based on where the dateline should be, that will tell us whether it is going to be, you know, a Shabbos, whether whatever given day is a Shabbos or Sunday. When Shkia in that point starts, that's when Shabbos begins. When Shkia a few inches on the other side of the dateline starts, which will take a few minutes later for the sun to get there, that's when Motzei Shabbos begins. So we need to have that line to figure out where that line is located. So simply, we don't know of any Gemaras that talk about an international dateline, but there is a Gemara. There's a Gemara Rosh Hashanah that talks about Chatzos Hayom. And the Gemara says that if the Nolad, the Molad of the Levana, was before Chatzos Hayom, you know that, let me say one point. Molad, at the Molad itself, you don't see the moon. You only see, Rashi says, you only see the moon 6 hours after the Molad. So when you see a sliver of the moon, that means it's 6 hours after the Molad. So the Gemara says, at least the way Rashi says, according to the way Rashi is going to explain this Gemara, as I'll tell you in a moment, it has nothing to do with an international dateline. According to Rashi, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah Chaf Hei says the following. If the Molad of the Levana is before Chatzos, if it's before Chatzos, it's in the morning, then you know that, the Gemara says, Biyadua Shanira Samach Lashkiya Sachama. Let's not get into Rashi's pshat. It's a complicated pshat and it has nothing to do with the dateline. The Balamor and the Kuzari see this Gemara, yes, talking about the international dateline. Let's try to present their position. The Balamor and the Kuzari say that, let's say we have Dei Shloshim, Dei Lamed, and we want it to be Rosh Chodesh. In order to be Rosh Chodesh, what do you need to have? You have to have that the entire 30th day, if you want it to be Rosh Chodesh, has to occur after the Molad. Meaning, what day is Rosh Chodesh? Whenever you have the Molad, the next full day after the Molad will be Rosh Chodesh. So, let's say you have a Molad at 5:59 p.m. and Shkia is at 6 p.m. So, since Shkia of the 6 p.m., there was already a Molad before that, that day that began at Shkia at 6 p.m. can become Rosh Chodesh. So, if you have the 30th day, we want to know, is this 30th day considered Rosh Chodesh or is it not Rosh Chodesh? If Shkia of the 30th day came after the Molad, then the 30th day will be Rosh Chodesh. However, let's say the Molad occurred sometime on the 30th day, the 30th day cannot become Rosh Chodesh. Now, we made a point, one second, so, to reiterate, if a moon is just seen on day 30, that's not enough to make it Rosh Chodesh. The Molad has to be seen before Shkia entering the day of the 30th, that 30th day. So, that din that I just said, that you in order for a day to be considered Rosh Chodesh, the moon has to appear, the Molad has to appear before Shkia, it doesn't have to be in Yerushalayim. As long as there's one place in the world where the Molad occurred before that place is Shkia, then that 30th day can be Rosh Chodesh. And therefore, the Gemara tells us what that would look like in Yerushalayim. So, the Gemara says that in Yerushalayim, if you have a Molad in Yerushalayim in the morning, before Chatzos, one second, the Baal Mora says like this. The first Shkia in the world is not Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is the sixth Shkia of the world. If the world has 360 degrees, so there are going to be a total of 24 hours in those 360 degrees. So every 15 degrees will have an hour of time. And the 6 hours, meaning 90 degrees before Yerushalayim, will be where the first Shkia in the world happens. So if the Molad would occur, let's say the Molad would occur on day 30 at 9 o'clock in Yerushalayim. 9 o'clock in Yerushalayim means that the first Shkia occurred 15 hours previously, because let's say 6 p.m. the previous evening was Shkia in the earliest place in the world. 12 hours to get to 6 a.m. Now it's 9 in the morning. That was 15 hours. So if the Molad is seen at 9 a.m. in Yerushalayim, that means that the Molad happened 15 hours ago. And therefore, you did not have a full day of the 30th day after the Molad. This will be true until midday. I'm sorry, you will have a 30th day as a full day of Rosh Chodesh, and that will be true until midday. What's midday? Midday in Yerushalayim, let's think about what midday in Yerushalayim is. Noon, Chatzos in Yerushalayim means it's 18 hours after Shkia in the first Shkia in the world. That means that if the Molad is seen in Yerushalayim by midday, that means it was seen in the earliest part of the world, 18 hours prior, before the entrance of the day 30 somewhere in the world, and it will be Rosh Chodesh that day. However, the Gemara tells us, if the Molad happens after Chatzos HaYom in Yerushalayim, that means it's more than 18 hours after the earliest Shkia in the world, to see after the first place in the world saw the moon. And therefore, that 30th day will not be entirely after the moon, and it will not be able to be Rosh Chodesh. Okay, I don't know if I did a great job in explaining that, but that's okay. We could still move on to understand the ideas of what's going to be with what are the nafkaminas that are going to come out from the international dateline. So the question of international dateline basically tells us the following. We have a certain line in halacha where on one side of the line is Shabbos and the other side is going to be Sunday. Now, the convention of the world people also have an idea where that civil dateline is. It's 180 degrees east of Greenwich, England. That's just the arbitrary point that they took. So if the civil dateline and our dateline were the same, so whatever people call Saturday is what we call Shabbos. Whatever people call Sunday is what we call Sunday. The problem is going to be if you're between what we say is the halachic dateline and what the world says is the civil dateline. If you're between those two lines, meaning you're to the right of the line where we call the dateline, and you're still to the left of the civil dateline, which is a place like Japan or New Zealand, that's going to be a question of what do you call that location. The world calls it Sunday, and we call it Shabbos, or the opposite. The world calls it Shabbos, and we call it Sunday. On one side of the line, it's Shabbos morning. On the other side of the line, it's Sunday morning. According to them, it's the same thing according to their dateline. So the Sefer Yesod Olam, one of the Rishonim, asks on everything that we just said, that there's a concept called an international dateline, and he says, wait a second, how could it be you have two people talking to each other? There's this arbitrary line between them. For one, they're talking to each other. For one, it's Shabbos. For the other, it's not Shabbos. And the same question in a different way. How could you say there's this line? You walk, you're right now you're in Shabbos. You walk across the line, now it's Sunday. You walk back 10 feet across the line, all of a sudden it's not Shabbos anymore, it's Shabbos again. You're switching, you know, based on where you're walking on your Shabbos afternoon walk. If you zigzag, you go into Shabbos, out of Shabbos, into Shabbos, out of Shabbos. How could that possibly be? So the way the Achronim understand this question of the Yesod Olam, this Rishon, is they're asking us, how could you have a dateline crossed through a landmass? And therefore, this Sefer is suggesting that you have to draw the line in a way that even if the line will cut through the landmass, you don't want to really allow that line to split the landmass in half. Therefore, we're going to push the line till the edge of that landmass. So let's say the line cuts through China. But it doesn't make sense to have two people on two sides of the line having different days or you're walking back and forth. So therefore, we're going to say the halacha sees this dateline pushed all the way against the Chinese coast between China and Japan. So as long as you're on your Asian air landmass, you still are not crossing the line. Once you get to the edge of that Asian landmass, that's where the end of the line will be. Others say, no, I don't care about your shilas, your questions about one side of the line, the other side of the line. If it's that's the line, that's the line. And they do go straight through the middle of a landmass. They don't care about that shila. Okay, so that's two dayas. However, if you have anything that would be cut off from that main landmass, like Japan and New Zealand, that are not connected to that main landmass, it will have one halacha according to it will be cut off from Asia, so it'll be Shabbos. So the Shabbos will be on a different day than on the other side of that line. Now, this that we said until now, based on the Baal Mor's explanation of the Gemara, the Chazon Ish adapts, all assumes that the dateline is 90 degrees from Yerushalayim, 90 degrees east of Yerushalayim. However, Rav Tukhachinsky assumes that no, the dateline is not 90 degrees east of Yerushalayim, not 6 hours east of Yerushalayim, but rather it's 180 degrees east of Yerushalayim, it's 12 hours east of Yerushalayim. The nafkamina between the original pshat, the Balmor with the Chazon Ish, and this new pshat of Tukhachinsky is what's the status of Hawaii. Hawaii, according to the Chazon Ish, Shabbos happens on Shabbos, but according to Rav Tukhachinsky, Shabbos happens on Friday. And that will be a Rav Daniel Stein went, he had some reason had to be in Hawaii. And he always told his Balabatim that they should avoid being in Hawaii on Shabbos because of this Shaila. And he made a point of saying that when he went to Hawaii, he had a chasa there or something, or was passing over there. He ended up being in Hawaii, or maybe his vacation. He made sure he was there only midweek. He didn't stay for Shabbos, not to have this Shaila of when is Shabbos in Hawaii. Okay. There happens to be a third opinion.
What if somebody moves to Hawaii?
What?
What if somebody moves to Hawaii for business or not sure?
Yeah, so it's machlokas. Depends who they ask. Some people say it's on Friday. Some people say it's Shabbos. Some people say be machmir for both. Yeah, that's what happened with the mir in Shanghai on Yom Kippur, that the Yushalmi Rabbanim against the Chazon Ish. So they said maybe if you're able to, you should try to fast for both days. Okay. So we'll just finish off this shir with a. There are other opinions about where to draw the international dateline. For example, Tzvi Pesach Frank says halacha doesn't really address this shaila, and therefore just follow the minhagim malkum. Whatever they call today, that's what you should call today. Not there's no objective date that is point that it defines it as Shabbos or not. Whatever they call it, that's Shabbos. So just two halachas that are not yotzei as nafkaminas from where to draw the dateline is davening. Let's say you're in Japan. And you daven, you're Monday morning, you're in Japan, and you daven Shacharis. So now you're going to fly from Japan back to New York over the Pacific. So you had Monday morning, you daven Shacharis. Monday afternoon, you daven Mincha. Then you travel through Monday night, and you land in New York, guess what? Monday morning, in time for Shacharis. But wait a sec, you daven Shacharis Monday morning. On the other hand, it's a new morning. You went through the night. So some say that it's a new morning. You went through a night, it was dark for a few hours, and it's a new morning to daven again. Others say, no, Monday morning was already davened in Japan. You don't have to daven again. That's one shaila. Another shaila would be a similar shaila. Let's say you're going again from Japan, from Hong Kong into L.A. You leave Hong Kong, Motzei Shabbos. You travel through the night, you get to L.A. when? Shabbos morning. So what did you just do? You left when it was not Shabbos, but you're landing in a place where it's Shabbos. So Rebelsky says that's not a nice thing to do. So those are some of the shilas regarding international dateline. Be'ez Hashem, I'll send you an email about when we'll do the Zoom conference for the next second half of the shir. So I'm going to turn off the recording. If anybody wants to ask me a question after I turn off the recording, you're welcome to.